Good morning. That was pretty sorry. Let's try that again. Good morning. That's much better. Brother Ray, I cannot out-energy you, brother. You just have a wonderful amount of energy, and you have a wonderful gift of singing, and I hope that you just keep on doing it for many years. Okay, I appreciate what you have done today. I remember when I was here before. Yes, I have been here before, but it was back in the days of Paul Kidwell, and sometime in the 1980s I was here either for a weekend or for a youth rally or something, but that was a good while ago. I do remember Brother Walker leading singing then, and it's good to see all of you here today. Glad to be here. So we're going to be talking about the Jesus of history. I'm going to have to glance up here every once in a while because I might forget something. There was a preacher, by the way, one time that was trying to quote Revelation 3 and verse 11, "Behold, I come quickly. Hold fast to that which thou hast, lest any man should take it from thee." So he came up to the podium and the pulpit and he said, "Behold, I come." And he forgot the rest of the passage. So he said, second time's a charm. So he stepped back and he says, "Behold, I come." And again, he forgot the rest of the passage. He said, "Third time is the charm. I'll get it right this time. Behold, I come." This time he came with such exuberance, he pushed the pulpit off the edge of the podium, landed in a sister's lap right there in the front row, and he was apologizing to her, "Ma'am, I'm so sorry." And she said, "That's all right, preacher. You warned me three times." So here we are. I'm going to have to look back every once in a while. I don't really have a monitor, but the elders have asked that I discuss some things today, and I'm glad to. I know several of your elders. I know several of you. If you went to Fried Hardeman, hands up. We'll see where you are. Good, good. That's great. Glad that you have gone. Keep on coming. Keep on sending your kids. Appreciate that very much. Debbie and Tommy, it's good to see you here. And you guys are doing well. Appreciate all of that. Well, I've got a lot of things I could talk about, but let's talk about this. The Jesus of history. The elders wanted me to talk about translations and this, and we have another topic tonight. Okay, so the Jesus of history. I don't know what you think Jesus looked like, and don't know anybody. Nobody really does, because Isaiah 53 tells us that he was not especially attractive in the way that he looked. He wasn't particularly comely in his appearance, as King James would say. So he wouldn't have stood out in a crowd. I used to think when he was a kid, you know, when he was a baby, what did Mary do with that halo every time, you know, she had to change Jesus? But really, he had no halo. I don't think he had a special glow about him or anything. And I do think that the guy on the left looks incredibly too white. You know, so I doubt that Jesus was very white. And maybe Jesus was more Jewish as the guy on the right-hand side you see there, but nobody really knows for sure. But all of us are pretty sure about this, that our country does not seem to be as a whole getting closer to Jesus. And therefore, one of the things that we need to do is to talk about going back to where Jesus is and going where Jesus is, because back to Jesus is an idea that we need individually, and we need this as a country. We will be better if we remember why we are here. Remember, a lot of people came on that boat. Now, by the way, the Native Americans did say hello to those who came over on the Mayflower and those other two ships. There were people here already, but those guys came over the Atlantic so they could set up a place of religious freedom. So whenever you think about this country, it was based on ideas like this, but Jesus does not seem to be to many people anything other than like the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus. You know, he's kind of like one of those things not very real. And so this morning I'm going to be talking about this. I had a discussion on May the 9th with a guy at the Warren Apologetics Center on the historical Jesus. This particular guy is different from some atheists because he has two legitimate PhDs. From Drew University, one in systematic theology, and the other in New Testament criticism. And he's written a lot of books, and he's got some journals out there. He was a Baptist preacher until 1994. I don't know exactly what happened in 1994, but now he's an atheist. And he's written a lot of books out there about Jesus not being able, Jesus not ever having existing. For instance, Jesus is Dead is one of his books. Or Jesus Christ Superstar, The Making of a Myth, or Inerrant the Wind, or Deconstructing Jesus, or The Case Against the Case for Christ, etc., etc., etc. He's written all these books. So I didn't know exactly how to approach a guy like this, but one of the things that I did when I went to school is that I studied under Thomas B. Warren. And Brother Warren tried to teach us that wherever you are and whatever you're doing, the truth can be clearly seen, and those people who are very educated need the gospel just as much as anybody else. So we had a discussion. You used to be able to see it on warrenapologeticscenter.org if you want to see it for free. The book will be coming out, I think, in a month or so. But when we're thinking about Jesus, what we're thinking about is that there are really three lines of evidence for Jesus being who we think he is. All right, and if you're watching today, I hope that you'll remember this. Three lines of evidence of why we believe that there was a Jesus of history and why he is significant in your own life. Number one, when we look at these three lines of evidence, would be this. There are the documents. If you were here during the Bible class hour, you are aware of how many documents there are. You know, if you were a member of some other church, for instance, and they have a book that that you can't study, for instance, there's no way to do textual criticism on the Quran because the Quran doesn't have any variant copies because they destroy the variant copies and those who own the variant copies back shortly after the time of Muhammad in the 7th century. So there are no variant copies. There are no variant copies of a lot of things out there, like the Book of Mormon, because nobody ever saw the original Reformed Egyptian, or there's no copies of it so that we can see whether or not Joseph Smith accurately translated what the Book of Mormon says. But I'm not here talking about churches. I'm here talking about people and ideas. The reason why I want to talk about that is because the documents themselves. The documents. We showed this picture in the morning hour because here were the original Dead Sea Scrolls discovered. What these men would do is that they would copy manuscripts. Most of them are of the Bible. Many of them were not of the Bible particularly, but they just copied stuff. And one of the things that they did copy was copies of the Bible. And they happened to store them away in jars and put them in caves like this, where it almost never rains, where the humidity is very low, and there are almost no environmental conditions whatsoever that would cause them to be destroyed. And so they stored them away there and stored them away there. What that meant for us is that meant before this time, there were no copies of the Old Testament that were any older than about 1,000 A.D. I did not say B.C., 1,000 A.D., during the time of the Masoretes, M-A-S-O-R-I-T-E-S. The Masoretic text is a good text, but that meant, you mean that's the earliest copy that we have of Old Testament books? And the answer is yes. Until the Dead Sea Scrolls, about 4 years before I was born. 1947, they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls, and that pushed back the age of some Old Testament documents by more than 1,000 years, indicating how wonderful it is. Is this working, by the way? It is or is not? I never know. I have a built-in loudspeaker, and so whatever. Okay, and so here's where they were found. Now, I want you to think about this. According to Daniel Wallace and the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts, there are 5,824 copies of the New Testament alone. 5,824. I would like to impress upon you one more time, 5,824. If you are a computer geek and you like to check this out for yourself, then go to the website of the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts. It is an acronym, csntm.org, and you can read them all if you wish. Now, they are in Greek, but you can read them all if you wish. Why? Because there's a bunch of them. And they come from different parts of the world. Many of them from the Middle East, but some of them from the southern side of the Mediterranean. Some from the northern side of the Mediterranean, and some from the eastern side of the Mediterranean. And they come from different people in different places. And there are how many? 5,824. Now, to put that in perspective, what does that mean? That means that, wow, we got a lot of copies of the Bible. And a lot of copies of the Bible in the original language helps you to be certain and reliable that the document that you are reading is from God. Now, why do you need to know that? Because you did not witness Jesus coming out of the grave. And if you did not witness Jesus coming out of the grave, you're going to have to depend on the documents. If the documents are reliable, then what they say is reliable. If the documents are not reliable, then maybe not. It was said of a woman one time when I was preaching in Knoxville that she'd rather climb up a tree and tell a lie than a stand on the ground and tell the truth. Well, once there is a non-reliable person in your presence and they've lied to you before, how do you feel the next time you're talking to them? You may or may not assume that what they're saying is the truth. Now, these documents are reliable because of the documents that are available. I mentioned in the early class, the oldest fragment that we now have, it dates back to about 121 to 150 A.D. And if John the Revelator dies at the end of the first century, after being exiled on the Isle of Patmos, then he's going to die about 100 A.D., 102 A.D., somewhere along in there. And then 20 years or less after that, there's a fragment of his gospel. Now, how important is that? There's no other book in the... I'm going to say this boldly, straight out. There is no other ancient book that's out there that has even a fraction of the reliability based on evidence that the Bible has. There is no other. You will not find it of any of the Greek mythologies. You will not find it of any of the Babylonian myth stories. You will not find it on the Code of Hammurabi. You will not find it anywhere else where you find the reliability that you find in your Bible. And so there's P46 and 86 pages of Paul's writings from no later than 200 A.D. Daniel Wallace says there's 7 New Testament papyri that are to be written about sometime the next year. He even thinks that one of them is from the first century. If he's going to be right about that, Brother Bush, that means that'll be the first century fragment or manuscript that we have. And that's during the time of the writing of the books themselves. So if that's going to happen, even if it doesn't happen, what you have is a tremendous amount of evidence that's out there. Now, in addition to the manuscripts, you also have things known as lectionaries. A lectionary is a church manual. Now, you don't have a church manual this morning. Why? Because we're all on automatic. Oh, just kidding. Okay, so you do not have a church manual this morning because the Churches of Christ, we don't do manuals. All right, and so what is a church manual? Well, in some of the churches later on, they would say, okay, now the preacher will be reading this, and now he'll be talking about this from this Old Testament text. Now, often, these books were written so that you could see the text in the original Hebrew, or you could see the text in the original Greek, or you could see the text in Jerome's translation into Latin. Therefore, when you look at that, these are called lectionaries or worship manuals in the church. We're not so interested in what the early church did because many of them were beginning to leave the New Testament pattern. However, what we are interested in is look at that text and see how accurate it is. And how many of them are there? Well, 128 papyri, that would be manuscripts. 322 are in big letters called uncial. Means there are probably no verse divisions. Brother David, you were talking about this with me after class. There are no verse divisions. There are no chapter divisions. There's very little punctuation. And by the way, there's no spaces generally between words. They're all jammed together. Why? Well, if you skin an animal and you prepare the skin to write a vellum manuscript on, you're going to use all the space you can. So why? It's kind of like these guys that text and they abbreviate words and stuff and all that business. Well, why? Well, you're abbreviating because, first of all, you can't drive and do this at the same time. I'm just kidding. Don't you dare do that. All right, but you abbreviate, don't you? And when you abbreviate, well, then hopefully the person that you're abbreviating it to is going to know what you're talking about. Well, these guys are going to scrunch up all the words, all capital letters, and there's 322 of those in the Münster Library in Germany. There are 1,997 a little bit later on when they began writing in long writing. Remember when you were in the second or third grade? Some of us the seventh or eighth grade. When you're in the second or third grade and you begin to write in long handwriting, cursive. Okay, so those are cursives. They're not quite as old as the uncial, but nonetheless very important to the Bible. And so there is so little gap between the copies and the actual letters that were written by the people who wrote them. There is so little gap. How much time is involved at a maximum? In many cases, 20 years. Now, compare that to Caesar. The writings of Julius Caesar would have been about 100 to 44 B.C. The earliest copy that we have is from 900 A.D., which means the copies are 1,000 years old, and we only have 10 of them. Compare that, for instance, to, you may have heard of Suetonius. I don't know why everybody went to Suetonius, but Suetonius is a Roman historian here, and he wrote from AD 75 to AD 160. The earliest copy that we have of his writings go back to 950 AD, which is an 800-year span, and there's only 8 copies. Now jump down to the New Testament, written approximately from the time of A.D. 45 to about A.D. 100. The earliest copy going way back there, maybe as early as A.D. 66. We'll see how that works out, but certainly as early as 125, mere decades removed from when they were written, and of course, more than 24,000 of them if you add together the lectionaries and the manuscripts. How many copies do you have? Can you see how your Bible stands out in comparison to all the other ancient documents? Number two, the second reason why I believe in Jesus is because of the eyewitnesses themselves. Now, the eyewitnesses, I forgot when I started to preach, Brother Ray, so I'm going to just go ahead. I don't know, since we're on television, if I'm supposed to stop at a certain time, I'll try to rush through some of this, but getting this out to you is more important than me looking at the clock. I'm going to assume that I'm going to stop sometime before lunch. Okay, no, I'm just kidding. Okay, number two would be the eyewitnesses, and who would that be? The Bible tells us that Jesus appeared to at least 16 groups of people. Now, at Fried Hardeman sometimes, we have a guy by the name of Jim Wand, a hypnotist, and he comes about every couple of years to Fried Hardeman and shows us all his hypnotic skills. Well, first of all, you got to have people who are subject to hypnosis, because some people are not. And secondly, you got students there, many of whom act like that in the dorm anyway. And so they naturally could get hypnotized to cluck like a chicken or whatever else. But a third thing is, you're in a controlled environment involving a few people, and they're all in the same circumstance at the same time. These 16 groups are not in a controlled environment. They are not hypnotized by somebody. They are not all experiencing the same apparition or the same ghost-like thing. How many do you have? Well, first of all, women, you should feel good about the fact that the women were the first witnesses, because in the Old Testament, women as witnesses didn't matter. I'm sorry about that, but they didn't. Calling a woman as a witness would be no different than calling a slave as a witness, and you wouldn't do that. But the first people who witnessed the resurrection of Jesus were the women. What were the men doing? Well, they were watching ESPN and had a remote control. Okay, and so what were they doing? Well, they weren't at the tomb. But now, wait a minute. Women, here's the other side of that. The women who went to the tomb did not expect for it to be empty, because they had spices to anoint the body with Jesus. If they knew he had been risen, they wouldn't have carried the spices. Group number two, the guards were a part of the cover-up, because they knew that the body was empty, the tomb was empty, and the body was missing. Number three, there were the 11 disciples. Number four, there was Simon. Number five, two men. Number six, the disciples. Number seven, Mary Magdalene. Number eight, 10 disciples. Number nine, 11 disciples. Number 10, 7 disciples. And then there was Peter in 1 Corinthians 15, 5. Excuse me. And then there are the 12 in 1 Corinthians 5. There are more than 500 brethren. We do not know if there is some overlap here. There may be. But there were more than 500 brethren. And then there's James, the half-brother of the Lord, in verse 7. Then there's all the apostles in verse 7. And then finally, as one who is untimely born, which means prematurely born, there's Paul, who was an apostle, and there he is. Jesus appeared to him on the road to Damascus in Acts 9, Acts 22, and Acts 26. Now, William Lane Craig is another very well-known apologist, and he talks about these bedrock facts. Number one, after his crucifixion, Jesus was buried in a tomb by Joseph of Arimathea. Now, you don't do that with mythical figures. You don't bury people who do not exist. And if you do, there's a special place for you in Nashville where they will provide you three meals a day and will direct your activities for you. All right, so what I'm saying here is, number one, that he really was a physical person. As John said, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Well, that's John 1. Well, 1 John 1 starts out like this. You know, that which was from the beginning, that which we have seen, that which we have heard with our hands, with our ears, that which our hands have handled concerning the word of life. And you know what John is saying to you? He was a real person. He was a real person. Therefore, fact number one. Fact number two, on the Sunday following the crucifixion, Jesus' tomb was empty, and he still is not there. He is still not at his empty tomb. Now, what difference does that make to them? Well, it made a huge difference. What difference does it make to you? You'll have to answer that one for yourself. Number three, on multiple occasions and under various circumstances, I've named 16 of them for you, different individuals and groups of people experienced appearances of Jesus alive from the dead. You know, we have some little churches in the area in Henderson, and some of them are a little bigger in Jackson, who believe that they're performing miracles. And yet, when I pass there, I never see a local TV truck, you know, with that big satellite dish on the top, because somebody has been raised from the dead. I never see anybody reporting from a local church that a man with a withered limb that is so atrophied that he cannot walk was restored during worship service. I mean, the local newspaper is not there. There are no web services that are there. There are no television shows that are there. And if they existed in the first century, they would have all been gathered around the tomb of Jesus, saying, "Where is his body? Where is his body?" Well, that's a bedrock fact, because otherwise, something could be produced that would say, "Oh yeah, here's the body of Jesus." The first line of evidence is the documents. The second line of evidence is the eyewitnesses. The third line of evidence is the changed lives. I'm talking about Jews who had been monotheists for 1,500 years. They believed in the one true God, and they're not going to worship anybody else other than Yahweh. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 4. Hear, O Israel. The Lord our God, the Lord, He is one. That is so famous in Hebrew, it's called the Shema, which means listen, Israel. Shema, Israel. Listen, Israel. The Lord our God, the Lord, He is one. Well, what has happened? Well, now these people are worshiping somebody else too. They're worshiping Jesus. Now, John Dominic Cresson is another reason not to go to Chicago. Okay, but in Chicago, he's one of the guys who started the Jesus Seminar movement in the late 1980s, and they're still active, by the way. And when asked, he believes that Jesus was only a mortal man, conceived and born the natural way. He performed no miracles, was killed, and his body probably eaten by wild dogs. Now, how many documents did I say we had? 5,824. How many documents do you have to prove that the body of Jesus was probably eaten by wild dogs? Now, here's a PhD who was in charge of the Jesus Seminar, a group of liberal scholars meeting at the University of Chicago, generally in Chicago, telling us that Jesus either never lived or that his, you know, he wasn't raised from the dead. It would have been real easy in the first century to solve that whole matter. We'd just clear off the Lord's Supper table and just spread out the dead body of Jesus, and that's the end of the matter. All you got to do is produce the dead body of Jesus, and that's the end of the matter. There'll be no Christian martyrs. There'll be no people worshiping Jesus as God. There'll be no people saying Jesus really was the Messiah and the risen Lord. There'd be none of that if they just would produce the body. They could not do it then, and they can't do it now. And the reason why they can't is because Jesus came out of the grave and He ascended into heaven, Acts 1 and verse 11. So what is it that changed these Jews? Now, in Larry Hurtado's book, he writes, Jesus, Lord Jesus Christ, devotion to Jesus in earliest Christianity. And in this, he talks about the fact that They were so committed. Now, this is before Gentiles entered the church officially in Acts chapter 10 with Cornelius. But in those first years, the first Christians were Jews. Devout men out of every nation under heaven. They were Jews. And now, here they are worshiping Jesus. This Jesus that you have crucified is both Lord and Christ. Therefore, they are no longer Unitarian. The word that he uses is binitarian. They're willing now to admit that Jesus is also God because they worshiped him. At the end of the book of Luke, after Jesus is risen from the grave and appeared to everyone, he directs his disciples to go wait in the city of Jerusalem for the coming of the Holy Spirit. And the Bible says, and they worshiped him. When the wise men came to the birth side of Jesus, and they worshiped him. When the shepherds came to where Jesus was, and they worshiped him. Sometimes it is controversial. I get a question every once in a while in open forum about whether or not it's okay to worship Jesus, because we have some brethren who might be a little concerned about some of the more modern songs where Jesus is worshiped. And they're just thinking, well, now there must be something wrong with that. Brother Ray, I wonder if they've never heard, Christ, we do all adore thee, and we do praise thee forever. What in the world is that song except a song of worship to Jesus? And it wasn't controversial until things started getting weird in a lot of congregations of the Churches of Christ, and then it became controversial. So I'm not trying to be controversial now, but I'm trying to tell you this. Not only is it okay to worship Jesus, you better. Because he was God, and he is God, and he is not unequal with God, according to Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 through 8. Therefore, in Revelation chapter 4, when the 24 elders and the four living creatures and the martyrs fall down at the end of Revelation 4 and the end of Revelation 5, glory and praise be to the Lamb who was slain. Glory and praise be to Jesus who was killed, and now he is in heaven and he's not going to die as a man anymore. Now, what does that have to do with you and me? Well, these people's lives were changed. But what about you? These people's lives were changed. But what about you today? And now the day is August the 25th and the year is 2013. In 1999, I sometimes thought, wow, is Jesus going to wait, you know, much longer than the year 2000? Although there was nothing in the Bible to tell us when Jesus is going to come back. Matthew 24 and verse 36. So I don't know when he's going to come back. But I am aware of the fact that he's God. Because in John 8:58, he uses the expression, the I am, in reference to himself. And there is no Jew worth his salt who has ever studied the Old Testament who would not know that he's talking about Exodus 3:14. Where in the burning bush, God introduces himself to Moses as the I am. Tell them the I am has sent you. In John 8:58, Jesus uses the I am in reference to himself. You know, that's like a red 18-wheeler. You can't miss it. I mean, how could you miss that? And so, one final passage. I mentioned this morning that in Luke chapter 4, there's a guy, Jesus, going back to his hometown congregation, synagogue, there in Nazareth. Sometimes a prophet is without honor in his own country. Not always true. Sometimes true. Jeff, you're not too far from here, and you've been here 11 years. Brother Lee Brown was here 30 or 35 years. It's not always true that a prophet is without honor in his own country, but sometimes, in this case, it was true. Because Jesus, as I see it in my mind's eye, he goes over and pulls a scroll out of the Torah cabinet. That would be Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And the other books of the Old Testament. He pulls out the Isaiah scroll, and he reads from Isaiah 61, verses 1 and 2. Now that's the part of Isaiah where he starts talking about the coming of the Messiah, the Anointed One. And he says that when the Messiah comes, he will turn the eyes of those who are blind so that they can see. And those that cannot walk, he will help them to walk. He will minister to the poor and the maimed, you know, sinners like you and me. Jesus reads this standing up, and then he goes over and sits down, and he says, "This passage is fulfilled in your midst," which means I am the Messiah. Not trying to brag at all. I want you to call me Ralph. Don't call me doctor. I'll charge you something. Okay, just call me Ralph. That's my name. Don't call me, you don't even have to call me Mr. Gilmore. That was my dad. But my name is Ralph. But I have preached a lot since I was 20 years old, by the grace of God, in a lot of different countries. And I've seen God take people and just turn them around. I mean, people who were, according to the world, as the world would see it, the greatest of sinners. Just take them and just turn them around. Not contrary to their will. I'm thinking about an elder, former elder in Buenos Aires, Argentina, Juan Fuente, and how that whenever he started studying, he did not want what he was hearing to be true because he was brought up in another church. His wife was even stronger because she had somebody, she had a brother in her family who was a priest, as I recall. So she didn't want it to be true either. But after studying the Bible and after accepting the Jesus of the New Testament, they come forward in a congregation, in the Iglesia de Cristo, in a congregation in Buenos Aires, and Juan comes, and then, no, Nilda comes first. And then, not too far behind her, comes her husband. I think of a real strong sheep herder in New Zealand, Palmerston North, New Zealand. When we left there, by the way, after being there one time on a campaign, he gave us a sheepskin, not one of those washed out things that you get at the tourist shop. I mean, this one was still bang. You know, this one was, and on the back it said, "Please take care of Basil." And it wrote, he had written, and he said, "Thank you for coming to New Zealand." His name is Wally. He couldn't stand the Church of Christ. And he couldn't discuss it with his wife because she was always right. He thought, and see, he couldn't have that. Because he could pick up sheep like this, you know, whatever size sheep it was, and just lay them over there and just shear them. There's six sheep for every person in New Zealand. And so he could do that. Strong guy. So rather than fussing with him, she'd just leave some Christian material near his recliner. And sometimes when she would go to bed early, she would kind of open the door and peep and kind of see that he was reading some of that stuff. It wasn't too long till Jesus changed him. And he was an elder. The problem with a lot of this is that for a lot of folks, it's just academic. You know, well, there's all those documents out there, and there's all those witnesses out there, and fine. What does that have to do with me? That, I think, is one of the reasons why the words are recorded. But whom do you say that I, the Son of Man, am? In Matthew 16. Some say Elijah. Some say John the Baptist with his head back on. The important thing is not what the person next to you thinks about Jesus or how good your daddy was or your mother in the church. Well, I've had people brag about it because, well, I don't personally go to church, but my granddaddy was a preacher in the Church of Christ. I view that with mixed feelings. That means something skipped a couple of generations. Because you're not there anymore. It's not about your grandmama and your granddad. It's not about your mother and your father. It's not about the person seated next to you. It's not about your preacher, and it's not about the elders. It is about you. I've given you reasons this morning for accepting Jesus, but whether or not you do it is really up to you. And when you do accept Him, how could you not have faith in Him? How could you not want to change your life if it's not the way that Jesus would want it to be? How could you not be willing to want to say, yes, Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? And why wouldn't you want to follow Him to the waters of baptism? Because He left that example for you. And so, back to Jesus as a country, I can't fix that. I can't fix the direction of the country. I can only work on myself and maybe a few others. And that's where you are too, while we stand and sing.